through them in immense ghostly gray strands. And in the middle distance, a swamp, 8,000 acres of it, glistening in the sun where the water broke clear of the stands of cypress and tupelo maples and the tangled thickets of cane, holly, greenbrier, and God knew what else. Even from up here, at this altitude, looking out the window of an airplane, you could tell that it was spring and that the swamp was coming alive. The branches of the cypress and tupelo maples were swollen with buds about to explode into foliage. He glanced at the Wiz. The Wiz was looking down, too, through his titanium frames. Just what the barcode scanners must have seen down there, he couldn't imagine. The outdoors, home of insects, snakes, and other irrational and undependable elements, probably left him feeling nothing, except a dermatitic itch. Charlie wanted to reach across the tupelo desk and take him by the shoulder and say, "Wiz, look at it! 29,000 acres, and it's all coming alive! The sap is rising, the eggs are hatching, the seeds are germinating. Snakes, puppies, foals, and little babies are being born. You think you're such a realist? Well, that's real life, what you see down there." Now the G-5 turned south again and came down even lower, and he could see the pale, sandy dirt roads running through the pines. He could see the sheds, there, there, and way over there, deep in the plantation. The ones he built for feeding and sheltering the mules and the horses during the quail shoots. And now he got his first glimpse of the white fences, miles of them it looked like, enclosing the vast clearing where the horses were turned out. 59 horses. And they all had to be turned out every day, and some had to be segregated to keep the troublemakers, particularly the stallions, from kicking or biting each other to bits. The pastures were that same brilliant green. And over there, 2 foals no more than 2 weeks old, kicking up their heels. He couldn't resist any longer. "Hey, Wiz, take a look right over there. See what I'm talking about, those 2 foals? I bet they're not more than 2 weeks old. I think one of 'em's first draws." You could just begin to make out the big house in the middle of a grove of live oaks, pin oaks, and southern magnolias, some of the oldest of them 80 feet high, which would put out such a towering profusion of white blossoms 2 months from now, he sometimes traveled to Turpentine in the middle of the summer just to see them. The house itself was not the sort of Greek Revival palace with the Ionic columns and the entablatures that the plantation parvenus had built just before the Civil War. The big house at Turpentine had been built in the early 1830s, with the low lines and deeply shaded wraparound porches and white clapboard siding and floor-to-ceiling double-hung windows of the true antebellum Old South. It wasn't even on high ground, because hills scarcely even existed in this part of Baker County. But what a show it was! The driveway, a broad dirt road with a sandy composition so fine and pale it looked almost white, curved for a mile through the pines before entering an avenue of live oaks planted so closely on either side that a month from now they would create a cool, dark, dense, green tunnel of foliage. Then it emerged into the clearing and made a grand loop, bordered by ancient boxwood in front of the house. The flower beds were ablaze with vivid red horseshoe geraniums, yellow bayberry bushes, violet-mauve masses of ethereal spear, orange kaffir lilies, crimson and yellow Japanese quince, and the flower he loved above all others, the early-blooming Confederate rose, which now, in the afternoon, was still white, but which by nightfall would be a deep rose, in mourning, folk said, for the blood shed by brave Confederate lads in the lost cause. It was breathtaking. Breathtaking! Charlie felt a catch in his throat. The G-5 was now beyond the big house. Ludd was bringing it down close to Juker's Swamp before swinging about and heading into the glide path to the landing strip. Down this low, and with so little foliage on the trees, You could clearly see the stands of cypress and black tupelo maple rising out of the water. You could see their huge, swollen knees just above the waterline. And there was the juke house, a big, white, clabbered structure on stilts, cantilevered out over the water, which he had built as a 12-bedroom guest house. Cost $2.4 million. Oh, how flush he had felt. Way back then. The landing strip was an alley of asphalt cut through a pine forest. It was almost a mile long, so as to accommodate a jet this big. What with the landing lights, the maintenance hangar and its asphalt apron, the fuel pumps, and the access roads that had to be built, the whole thing had cost him $3.6 million. He thought about that as the pines whizzed by in a blur on either side, and they glided in and touched down for the landing. When they reached the hangar apron, Durwood was out there with the big Chevrolet Suburban, as promised, and Rufus Dotson, the black man who was in charge of the crew that maintained the runway and the hangar, was standing beside it. As soon as Charlie slid himself out from under his tupelo desk, he could tell his right knee had stiffened. He didn't want to be seen hobbling down the stairs, not even in front of Durwood and Rufus. But it couldn't be helped. His knee hurt so much he had to hold on to the cable that served as a railing. When he reached the bottom, Rufus was right there waiting. He was a short, squarely built man, in his 50s, or his 60s. Charlie never had known his age for sure, with dark skin and gray hair that stuck out on either side of his head. He wore an old-fashioned cap like a golfer's cap that covered the top of his head, which was bald. He touched the cap's little visor respectfully with the thumb and forefinger of his right hand and said,
"How you doing, Captain Charlie? Let me give you a hand."
He reached out with his big, powerful right hand. He was wearing a long-sleeved gray work shirt of a sort you seldom saw anymore, buttoned at the wrist, and a pair of jeans. "Oh, it's all right, Rufus," said Charlie, who would rather have died than be helped down those stairs. "It's just that damn knee of mine from playing football." Rufus chuckled deep in his throat and said, "You don't have to tell me about the rheumatiz, Captain Charlie." "Mine's not rheumatism, damn it," Charlie wanted to say. "Mine's from football." All around were the deep, cooling shadows of the pines, which reached up 100 feet or more. But out here on the hangar apron it was painfully bright. Charlie squinted. Mirage slicks flared up in front of your eyes when you looked back down the runway, and caloric waves rose from the asphalt. It made him feel hot and tired and weak. Durwood was ambling over from the Suburban.
"Hey, Cap'n," said Durwood. "Mr. Strook?"
Every time Charlie saw this big man and heard his deep Baker County voice, he just knew that he was the archetype of what the overseers had been back when overseers rode herd on the field hands who were slashing pine out in that murderous heat 10 or 12 hours a day. Not only before the Civil War, but for a good 50 years afterward. Slashing pine was as hellish as working in the pulp mills, the way Uncle Bud told it. It drove men so close to the ragged edge, the overseers used to sleep with loaded shotguns by their beds. That Durwood could have lived such a life, Charlie had not the slightest doubt. He was stone-cold Georgia cracker top to bottom. He was one of those big men who are more intimidating in middle age than ever before, because their hide has gotten tougher, and they've learned what it takes to be mean in a calculating way, which is the meanest way of all. He was about Charlie's height, a few inches over 6 feet. His head and neck were huge, and everything seemed to droop, his eyes, his cheeks, his nose, his mouth, which gave him a perpetual scowl. His beefy shoulders drooped, his huge chest drooped, and his belly drooped over his belt, and some sort of horrible and irresistible power seemed to be packed inside all that flesh. He wore a khaki-colored shirt with the sleeves rolled up over his immense forearms, and khaki balloon-seat twill pants whose cuffs rested on top of a pair of old, battered calf-high boots of the sort that anybody in Baker County, who spent time in the fields, wore as protection against the rattlesnakes, which usually went for the ankles. Riding on top of his big hips was a gun belt and a holster with the handle of a huge 45 caliber revolver showing. The revolver was for shooting snakes. "Hey, Durwood," said Charlie, "is that first draws foal I saw over here kicking up his heels when we was coming down?" He said it mainly to get some conversation going, to keep everybody thinking about something else while he step-gimped, 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 step-gimped the 20 or 30 feet to the Suburban.
"Spike it was, Cap," said Durwood. "Tell you what, if you and Mr. Strook ain't too hungry yet, I'm going to swing on over before we get to the gunhouse. That's the biggest, kickin'est damn foal. I ain't never seed one that big. Not for no damn 2 days old, anyhow."
So the three of them, Charlie, Durwood, and Wismer Strook, got in the Suburban, and they swung on over there by the stables and the enclosure where First Draw's big foal was kicking up his heels. No sooner did they get out of the vehicle than they saw five or six of the black stable hands and the two little Australians, Johnny Groiner, the stud manager, and Melvin Bonnetbox, his steerer, standing in a semicircle out on a whitish sandy road where it emerged from the palmetto scrub and wire grass into the open space by the stable. They were so absorbed in whatever it was they were looking at, they barely even noticed that the Suburban had pulled up with their overseer, Durwood, and the master of Turpentine, Captain Charlie Croker. Durwood didn't take that too well, not with his boss having just arrived.
"Hey!" he yelled out. "Can't you boys think of nothing to do except cluster-fucking in a ballin' sun?"
Cluster-fucking was a term Durwood had picked up in Vietnam, where soldiers in the field weren't supposed to gather in clusters, lest all be wiped out by a single strike. To Durwood's and Charlie's surprise, Johnny Groiner, a chesty elf with close-cropped ginger-red beard, turned toward them and put his forefinger to his lips and motioned with his other hand as if to say, "Come on over and take a look at this." So Durwood, the Wiz, and Charlie, limping worse than ever, walked on over, and right away they saw what all the fuss was about. On the edge of the road, next to a clump of palmetto scrub and wire grass, out in the boiling sun, was a diamond-back rattlesnake, a huge one, 6 feet long if it was an inch, maybe 7, motionless, torpid. A cold-blooded creature, it had found that toasty stretch of sandy road out in the sunshine of an April afternoon. And it was soaking it up, oblivious of the growing audience. It was a monster, even for a part of Georgia notorious for big rattlers. It had such girth that you could see its skin's entire pattern of big and small brown diamonds outlined in black against a tan field. The stable hands stood a respectful distance to the rear. No one dared approach the head. Rattlers had no lids over their eerie vertical slits for eyes, and no one knew whether they actually slept or not. One of the black stable hands, Sonny Colquitt, said,
"Hey, Captain Charlie, what you want to do with that big sucker? Want me get a hoe?"
He meant a hoe to chop the head off with. Charlie stared at Sonny. Then he stared at the snake, which was a magnificent brute. And then he was aware that everybody else, including Durwood and the Wiz, was staring at him, Captain Charlie. So he said to Sonny, "Go get me a croaker sack." He motioned toward the stable, and Sonny hightailed it toward the stable to get a croaker sack, that being the local term for a burlap bag. While Sonny was gone, Charlie took off his jacket and loosened his necktie. He didn't care if they saw his saddlebags, because they wouldn't know what they came from. And nobody in Baker County was surprised to see a man sweating in the first place. Mainly he wanted to give them a proper eyeful of his huge chest, his broad back, his massive neck. Gimp or no gimp, he was still Cap'n Charlie Croker. In no time, Sonny was back with the croaker sack. He handed it to Charlie. Charlie held the sack in his left hand and stepped through the semicircle of gawkers, right between the other Australian elf, Melvin Bonnetbox, and one of the new black employees, Kermit Hoyer, and advanced toward the snake. Step gimp, step gimp, step gimp, step gimp. He walked as slowly and softly as he could, pausing by the row of rattles, eight of them. Still had the original button, or so it looked like. And now he crept on toward the head, and a strange and wondrous thing happened. The pain began to recede from his knee. He was now close enough to the beast's head to see its graceful heart shape and the sinister but beautiful mask of black that ran across its face and eyes. And now he stepped across its body, so that he was straddling the great, somnolent brute. He knew that what he was about to do was foolhardy, and he knew he would do it anyway. The only sane way to go about it would be to get a sapling branch and whittle it into a forked stick and pin the snake's head down first. But by the time he managed to get a forked stick made, the beast might come to and retreat into the underbrush, and everybody would just be staring at poor, feckless, gimped-up Cap'n Charlie. No, there was no other choice but the foolhardiest possible way. He could no longer hear a thing from the outside world. A rushing sound like steam filled his skull. He was no longer aware of telling his 60-year-old body what to do. He crouched. He leaned over at the waist. And a flash of white filled his brain. And he thrust his right hand down and grabbed the rattlesnake around the neck at the base of its skull. With a single motion, he straightened up and swept the reptile off the ground and held its head out in front of himself at arm's length. He had done it! He had done it right! Right behind the jaws he had him. 1 inch off in either direction, one slip of the fingers, and the brute would have sunk its fangs into his forearm. But he had done it! The snake was now 6 or 7 feet of writhing, bestial anger. Its huge mouth was wide open, and its 2 fangs, which were truly like hypodermic needles, were erect. And it bit at the air, and great gouts of yellowish venom spurted from the fangs. And its forked black tongue flicked in every direction, and a hissing sound burst from its throat. The beast was more than 6 feet of muscle, vertebrae, and ribs, literally hundreds of ribs. And it lashed about until Charlie wondered if he could maintain his grip much longer. A heavy musk, like a skunk's, spewed from the snake's body and choked the air, and to Charlie in that moment it was as rich as frankincense and myrrh. But above all there was the sound of the rattles. A chattering terror fills the place. That was from a poem about rattlesnakes by somebody. Somebody Hart? That Charlie had read in high school. It was one of the few poems he had ever willingly memorized. The wild bird hears, smote with the sound, as if by bullet brought to ground. On broken wing, dips, wheeling round. Smote with the sound. Full-grown, 1-ton horses would bolt on you when they heard the terrible castanet of the rattlesnake. That sound seemed to be a trigger of terror built into the nervous system of every creature possessing the sense of hearing, including, above all, man. Charlie turned and held out the rattling beast toward everyone in the semicircle, and they all shrank back, even Durwood, as if the incredible Cap'n Charlie were about to march upon them and cram the venomous serpent down somebody's windpipe. In fact, Charlie wondered how much longer he could hold the damn thing. Seldom did a rattler weigh more than 5 pounds, but this one did, and it was thrashing with tremendous jerks and spasms. On the other hand, as Charlie well knew, it couldn't thrash like a buggy whip, and it couldn't wrap itself around his arm. It could only thrash from side to side, in a lateral plane. And once its belly lost contact with the ground, it was disoriented. The whiz, he noted with grim satisfaction, had now drifted back a full 20 feet. He who would live forever had done an instantaneous back-of-the-envelope calculation and decided that the vicinity of the Chevrolet Suburban was a better strategic alternative than any place anywhere near that whitish sandy road, above which a gigantic terror-chattering rattlesnake now thrashed in the grip of his boss gone berserk. Charlie gave them all one more terrible look down the gaping, venom-spouting gullet, and then he flopped the mouth of the croaker sack open with his left hand, and thrust the head of the rattler down into the bottom of it. Then he released his grip on the snake and jerked his right hand and arm out of the sack and drew the drawstring tight and held the sack aloft by the strings. The sack was now a hive of primal anger. The burlap thrashed about furiously. The clattering terror filled the place, and you could see the beast's fangs knifing through the fabric's loose weave and squirting its seemingly inexhaustible supply of venom into the air. "All right, y'all," said Charlie, in a tone of coldest command. "Come on over here." He started walking toward the snake house, which was about 50 yards beyond the stable. He held the croaker sack far out from his shoulder, suspended by the drawstrings. He'd known of cases where men had gotten bitten by diamondbacks because they let the bag get too close to their bodies. The strain on his arm was fierce, but he was damned if he was going to ask anybody else to help him. Not now he wasn't. Not after having gone this far. Out of the corner of his eye he could see the others forming behind him in a straggling line, with the whiz bringing up the rear. He could hear a couple of the stable hands going, It was music to his ears. Charlie's body was gimping on him a little bit, but he didn't feel a thing. He felt light on his feet. He felt as if he was floating. He had done it. And he was about to do more. Inside, as well as outside, the snake house was an absolute jewel of a little building. Or that was the way Charlie saw it. Outside its octagonal, almost circular shape, and its ancient red brick, meticulously hunted down by Ronald Vine, and its white wooden trim and its heavy slate roof, made it look like one of those little buildings Charlie had seen when he was in Virginia, and had visited Monticello and Colonial Williamsburg. Up on top, where the 8 sides of the roof came to a point, instead of a weather vane or anything like that, there was the bronze sculpture of a coiled rattlesnake. Inside, and this had been Ronald Vine's true stroke of genius, the snake house's tiny interior was lined with what at first looked like some sort of lurid wallpaper. But then you realize the stripes were in fact rattlesnake skins, flattened out and stretched up vertically and touching, edge to edge, so that they created a vast field of rough, scaly diamonds. Around the lower part of the little 8-sided room ran an ornate white wainscoting, and at the top of the wainscoting was a wide white counter. And in the center of the counter, on each of 7 wall sections of the octagon, the 8th was devoted to the doorway, was a big glass aquarium, or, better said, terrarium. And in each terrarium were live snakes from the fields and swamps of turpentine, rattlers, copperheads, cottonmouths, and corals, all of them poisonous and all of them deadly. There were plenty of turpentine employees, black and white, who didn't even like to go inside the snake house. They had a sound instinct. You steer clear of snakes, and when you see them, you kill them. Some of the boys believed snakes were the devil's agents. So the little band that followed Cap'n Charlie into the snake house, they were quieter than they would have been if they were going into a Methodist church. Charlie carried his croaker sack over to the far wall, where there was a terrarium with 6 huge rattlesnakes, each one almost as big as the one in the sack, slithering around one another like the devil making his appearance on earth in a slimy moving knot of coils, bristling with fangs and swollen with pent-up venom. Sonny, Durwood, Kermit, Johnny, and Bonnie, as Melvin Bonnetbox was called, All of them hung back. The Wiz truly hung back. He made sure he was nearer the door than the terrarium. Charlie shifted the croaker sack from his left hand to his right hand, and then, without asking anybody's help or looking at a soul, he lifted up one end of the wire-mesh grill over the terrarium and laid the mouth of the croaker sack on the lip of the glass. Then he lifted the bottom of the croaker sack up to about a 60-degree angle. You could see the snakes in the bottom of the terrarium looking up at the croaker sack and Charlie's bare left hand and wrist. Then you could see the head of the rattler in the croaker sack beginning to protrude from the sack's mouth. That head and those fangs and that venom were no more than 6 inches from Charlie's left hand, which held up the lid. Now more and more of the snake's huge body began to slither out of the mouth of the sack. Suddenly the serpent thrust its entire body, all 6 or 7 feet of it, out of the croaker sack and flopped down among its brethren in the bottom of the terrarium, and joined the moving knot of slithering coils. Ever so gingerly, Charlie lowered the lid and withdrew the croaker sack. For a moment he just stood there and stared at the 7 rattlesnakes inside the terrarium. The biggest of them all, the newcomer, the monster he had picked up with his bare hand, slithered about amongst all the deadly coils in a state of high agitation. Then Charlie stepped back about 2 feet and stared some more. Out of the corners of his eyes he noticed that the boys, including even the Wiz, had now stepped forward to get a closer look. So he reached in his pants pocket, withdrew his car keys, concealing them in his fist. He stared at the serpents a few beats longer. Then, suddenly, threw the keys against the side of the terrarium. The angry newcomer struck the spot first, his fangs smashing into the glass. But the other 6 hit the same spot, fangs bared, within the next fraction of a second. Everybody in the room except for Charlie jumped back, as if rocked by an explosion. Even Durwood, even Sonny. And the Wiz, he who would live forever, was almost out the door. Charlie turned around and let his gaze run over the whole bunch of them one by one, and then he said, in the calmest voice imaginable, "Boys, that's one damn fine snake." Outside the snake house, as they dispersed, the others were conversing excitedly with one another. But not the Wiz. He was standing alone, his hands in his pockets. Charlie walked over to him, and he wasn't conscious of any gimp at all in his right leg. He put his arm around the young man's shoulders, and he said, "Wiz, I've been thinking it over. I've made up my mind. We're going to do it. We're going to lay off 15% of the food division." The Wiz didn't look at his boss. He just nodded yes and looked straight ahead. Behind the titanium frames, his barcode scanner eyes were open wide enough to take in the world. Charlie Croaker felt almost whole again. Chapter 4 Beige Half-Brothers. The office of the mayor of Atlanta, Roger White's old Omega Zeta Zeta fraternity brother at Morehouse, Wesley Dobbs Jordan, was up on the 2nd floor of the 1989 addition to City Hall, the new part of City Hall, the part you entered from Trinity Avenue. You found yourself in a lobby, a rotunda that struck Roger as very modern, but at the same time very grand, which was a big admission for Roger to make to himself, because he didn't have much patience with modern architecture and decor. His own taste had never tolerated much that came after Edwin Lutyens. But this rotunda wasn't bad. It was all gray Georgia marble, which rose 3 stories to a fabulous dome with a skylight that flooded the place with a sunlit radiance, even on a dreary day like this one. On either side, marble stairways led up to a balcony on the 2nd floor, whose immense brass railing ran clear around the rotunda like a crown. God, Roger thought, with a stab of envy, West Jordan has made it. if he runs this kingdom. Well, there was no use being envious of Wes, was there? Wes was unique. Wes had always had a 12-month supply of confidence. He was a short, somewhat pudgy little guy, but at Morehouse he had been more than just an exemplar of the Morehouse man. He had been the Morehouse man and a half. He had been president of Omega Zeta Zeta and president of the student body. He was a light-skinned blue blood, related to many important figures of the old, sweet Auburn black elite. And from the start he had been a leader because he was going to be a leader. Roger was a light-skinned blue blood himself, and kin to perhaps as many prominent people as Wes was. But he had never had the implacable confidence that Wes had, or the withering cynicism with which Wes cut all enemies down to size. You couldn't pull any of that authentic black business on Wes. With a few words he'd take some blacker-than-thou fool's own words and stick them between his ribs and into his gizzard before the sucker knew what was happening. And now Wes was mayor of Atlanta, and he, Roger, was approaching the throne of the monarch of the Marble Rotunda, seeking, like everyone else, a favor. Well, at least I know him on a first-name basis, thought Roger. I won't have to stand there murmuring Mr. Mayor with my hat in my hand. Not, it occurred to him, that he was wearing a hat. But he had gone to the trouble of putting on the richest-looking ensemble he possessed. A navy, hard-finished worsted suit with pinstripes, nipped in at the waist. A tab-colored shirt with a white collar and spaced-out pale-blue stripes on the shirt front. A solid French-blue crepe de chine silk necktie from Charvet in Paris. And a pair of close-soled, cap-toed, highly polished black shoes that fit him in the insteps like a pair of gloves. Debouching from the breast pocket of his jacket was a white silk handkerchief salvaged with French blue. Once you walked up the stairs and went through the doors of the mayoral domain, you found yourself before a long, modern counter, behind which sat a pretty black receptionist, late 20s if Roger had to guess, with medium dark skin and carefully coiffed, relaxed hair. As soon as he announced his name, she said brightly, "Oh, Mr. Wyatt, have a seat. It'll only be a minute." Very brightly, in fact, and with such a warm smile that Roger turned off his status radar, which had been dialed up to detect even the slightest sign that he was being treated like any other humble petitioner before His Eminence. In the rear of the reception area, a huge white policeman sat at a desk, eyeing him with a neutral expression that changed into a small, polite smile when Roger looked directly at him. Security. White. Receptionist. Black. A white cop and a black receptionist. Roger wondered if Wes always arranged it this way, black and white, one of each, since the petitioners who arrived in this place would be white as well as black. In fact, the only other person waiting in the reception area, sitting on a couch, was a white businessman, about 50. Or Roger took him to be a businessman. He had on the typical Atlanta white businessman's garb of the moment, a nondescript, shapeless, mall men's store, off-the-rack dark suit, a striped shirt, and a pizza grenade necktie, as Roger called the current necktie genre. It was the sort of tie that looked as if a pepperoni and olive pizza had just exploded on your shirt front. Even black businessmen were wearing them. And Roger had always just naturally assumed that black businessmen dressed more subtly, as well as more stylishly, than their white counterparts. And the shoes. White businessmen just didn't understand about shoes. They didn't wear close-soled shoes. They wore them with soles that stuck out like sidewalks. Roger Too White took a seat across from him in a leather easy chair that made a luxurious whooshing sound as he sank into it. Idly he looked about. A lot of English furniture of the sort Wes had always liked, Sheraton and Hepplewhite. Wes had it in his home in Cascade Heights, too. The place looked like an old-line men's club, such as the Commerce Club or the Capital City, which Roger had been inside a few times for lunch. And yet, something was jarring the pattern, the mental atmosphere of the room. Then Roger noticed the curtains on either side of the window. Enormous things these curtains were, heavily pleated and draped. Yoruban cotton. Yoruban. The bold black, red, and yellow Yoruban designs were unmistakable, even with the material so heavily pleated and folded in upon itself. And up there on the wall, above the couch, set against the dark paneling, fantastic African carvings in stone and ivory. Antelopes, wildebeests, lions, cheetahs, plus fabulous creatures that came from out of Yoruban myths. And over there on the adjoining wall, two lurid but stunning and probably very valuable witch-doctor masks, and a pair of crossed spears with distinctive Yoruban tassels hanging from the metal necks just below the spearheads. Oh, Roger recognized it all, because during his junior year at Morehouse, he had been one of the students chosen to go on a tour of Yoruba land during spring break. Why couldn't those wallowing freaknickers of today think of something constructive like that? He had gone on a tour of Yoruba land in the hinterlands of Lagos, Nigeria, with a group led by Dr. Michaels and Dr. Pomeroy. And why? Roots. It was generally believed by scholars that a high percentage of the slaves who had come to America had been seized in Yoruba land, which had been the seat of a great civilization, perhaps the greatest civilization in all of Africa. The houses of the chiefs were magnificent structures. Some of them had as many as 50 rooms, richly decorated with carvings and symbolic devices just like the ones on these walls. And then Roger remembered. Wes had been on that trip. Wes would remember all this stuff as vividly as he did. He got up from the chair and approached the receptionist. "Excuse me," he said. Her lovely smiling face turned toward him. "I was just wondering." He gestured toward the carvings on the wall above the couch. "How long have these carvings been here?"
"About 2.5 weeks, I guess."
"And these?" He gestured toward the mask and the spears.
"Same thing," said the receptionist. "The mayor brought them in. I think he brought them from home."
"No kidding," said Roger. And then he realized the expression sounded almost as silly as it had when he had said it to Coach Buck McNutter the other night. Then he said, "They're stunning." He repeated the phrase several times on the way back to his chair, in a slightly narcoleptic fashion, talking to himself. "Yes, they're stunning. They're stunning." All the while he was thinking, "From home? Wes Jordan's been collecting Yoruban art?" He was still puzzling over this fact. Wes Jordan had never shown the slightest interest in African art after their return from Yoruba land, not even during the height of Afrocentrism in the late 1960s and early 1970s. He was still puzzling over it when a woman came bustling out of a door on the side wall, slightly behind the receptionist, and said, with much heartiness and a big smile,
"Mr. White, I'm Gladys Caesar. If you'll come with me, the mayor's been looking forward to seeing you."
Roger sized up Gladys Caesar immediately. She was the sort of chunky, highly energetic, relentlessly well-organized middle-aged woman, neither light-skinned nor terribly dark either, who, since time was, had gotten things done in the community. He followed her down a long hallway lined on one side by glassed-in shelves bearing an astonishing array of objets. Two Japanese ceramic dolls, clad in real cloth kimonos of fabulous richness and complexity, adorned with some sort of large lake-red discs. A lalique glass bowl with an Art Deco nude rising from the rim. A fragment, but a big one, of an apparently ancient Italian bas-relief. A 15 or 16 inch high bronze figure of a mustachioed New York City policeman from the turn of the century, mounted on a horse and wearing a capelet over his shoulders. An exquisite model of a 19th-century ship inside a big bottle with a narrow neck. These objets, each one more expensive-looking than the previous one, stretched on and on, behind glass. Before Roger could ask the question, Gladys Caesar answered it for him.
Gifts from visiting dignitaries. The Japanese never come without a gift. They'd consider that bad manners.
The hallway led past a couple of small offices and down toward two big mahogany doors. When they reached the door on the left, Gladys Caesar produced a key and unlocked it, pushed it open, gestured toward a big couch upholstered in white tweed, and said softly, with the warmest possible smile,
"Have a seat. He'll be right in."
Roger looked about. He was in what looked like a living room. A modern living room, but a spectacular one. There was a single, wide, floor-to-ceiling window, which also served as a sliding door, that looked out onto a balcony. The balcony, like the rest of the building, was made of a pale precast concrete. But a modernistic, dark metal railing and balusters created a pattern that gave it high style. The back of the couch was within 4 or 5 feet of the window, and in front of the couch was a glass coffee table with a beveled top that looked 2 inches thick at least, supported by a simple but magnificently forged brass frame. The floor was covered by a thick rug, with a dark brown geometric shape repeated against a white background. Upon closer inspection, Roger could see that the shape was that of a phoenix, the mythical bird that rises from the ashes, the symbol of Atlanta, which had twice burned to the ground and sprung back up. On one end of the coffee table was a stack of oversized picture books, and in the center of the table, a superlative Yoruban divination cup resting atop the foot-high figures of a horse and rider carved in a reddish wood in the ancient Oyo style. Stunning. Yes, stunning. And then he noticed the walls, which at first glance he had assumed were more mahogany, because they were so dark. But now he could see what they really were. Ebony, from floor to ceiling, without any bevels or other decorative incisions. Displayed on the wall, opposite where he stood, a massing of what must have been at least a dozen Yoruban ceremonial swords, each one 18 inches or so in length, carved in ivory in the most intricate detail. The ebony behind them brought out all the lace-like apertures in the sword's blades. Stunning. Stunning. Roger was still staring, agape, when he heard a door open off to the side. Coming toward him across the phoenix rug, from out of what appeared to be a smallish office, was Wes Jordan, all 5 feet 7 inches of him, beaming. He opened his arms and held his hands up as if preparing for an embrace, and said in a deep voice, "Brother White! Brother White!" Roger immediately recognized this as Wes's put-on voice, his ironic, authentic black voice, and he knew brother to have two meanings, both of them ironic. Brother White, as in Omega Zeta Zeta fraternity brother, and Brother White, as in my African-American soul brother. When he drew close, Wes didn't embrace him, as Roger thought he was about to. Instead, he raised his left hand, palm open, and said, "Hey, Blood, gimme 5. Roger slapped the mayor's palm with his own, obligingly, even though he knew this was a put-on, too. Then the mayor raised his right palm and said, "Gimme high, Blood." Roger slapped his palm up high. Then the mayor lowered his left hand, palm up, almost down to knee level,
and said,
"Gimme low, blood."
Roger slapped the palm down low. Then, to his surprise, the mayor did embrace him. He threw his arms right around him and rested his head, cheek by jowl, to Roger's, and said in a perfectly normal voice, with evident sincerity,
"It's good to see you, brother. I don't know where the time goes."
Then he stepped back abruptly and looked Roger up and down, from his gleaming, sweet, close-soled black shoes, up to his white tab collar and charvet necktie, and back down to his feet again. A deep voice back in the mock authentic black mode once more.
"Ain't we da butters, baby? Ain't we da butters? What's up, bro?"
The butters was current street slang, the hip-hop pronunciation of the butters, which was the latest term for smooth or slick or cool, particularly in matters of clothing. Roger was surprised that West Jordan even knew the term. He had only just heard of it himself.
"How you know about the butters, brudder?"
said Roger, slipping into Wes's put-on diction in spite of himself.
"Oh, baby," said the mayor, "you didn't know you was looking at a down cat? You didn't know you was looking at Mr. Mean Streets of Atlanta? The question is, how does a ringer, fleecem and tick bitch in a suit like you know about the butters?"
"In case you didn't know," said Roger, once more mimicking the mayor's jive voice, "I got 11-year-old boy in the house. Whatever trash you got lying out there littering the streets of this town you running, he's gonna bring it home, long as it's homey, cool, and straight from the ghetto."
They both started laughing, and Roger took this moment to look his old fraternity brother up and down. In contour, he was the same old West Jordan, a little too round, a little too chubby, wearing a perfectly good, but not striking, dark gray suit, a white shirt, and a pizza grenade necktie. Him, too. But his light tan face looked harder and squarer than Roger remembered it, and his hair was receding pretty deeply. All to the good, actually, it occurred to Roger. After all, his old pal was now the mayor of Atlanta. As it had always been, Wes's hair was naturally straight enough for him to comb it back in waves. In fact, it occurred to Roger at that moment, West Jordan could probably have passed for white if he had ever wanted to work on it, if he had ever wanted to move to another city somewhere and start out from zero. But what did a man like Wes need with white and zero? He was 43 years old and already mayor of one of the four or five most important cities in the United States. No, Wes didn't need a thing to improve himself in the credentials department. He was a true sweet auburn blue blood. In fact, his blood was about as blue as black blood got. His whole act, ever since he'd emerged from his office and come toward Roger, had been vintage West Jordan irony, which he had perfected more than 2 decades ago, way back in their Morehouse College days. Wes was the first in their group, or the first Roger was aware of, to isolate and make fun of the custom among black professionals and intellectuals of greeting each other with an exchange of some form of authentic black street talk. It was an unconscious way of expunging guilt, guilt over being so many fortunate levels above one's black brethren, who truly were denizens of the streets, of expressing solidarity, of symbolizing an eternal awareness and vigilance in the face of a white society that, in point of fact, did not distinguish between those different levels of black males and did not even want to. But to West Jordan it had always seemed phony, nonetheless, and when he engaged in it, he made it so ironic that you had to be a pretty dim bulb not to get the point. Wes might have his faults, but being insecure about his status in this life had never been one of them. Roger said, "You'll never guess who I started thinking about soon as I walked into your waiting room out there."
"Who?"
"Professor Milford Pomeroy."
"Ah," said the mayor, "Pom-Pom Pomeroy.
Can you guess why?"
I'll take a wild guess. I'll take a wild guess. Could it be that you spied a few treasures of the Oyo and the Owo out there on the walls?
You got it, said Roger. But I was really surprised. You and Yorubanart?
Oh, we've gone to some pains to put down some Yoruban roots in this office.
Your receptionist,
Miss Beasley,
the same smile.
A very attractive young lady, said Roger.
Yes, she is, said the mayor.
Miss Beasley told me you brought all these pieces in here. I never knew you collected Yoruban art. I hope you don't mind me saying so, Mr. Mayor, but collecting Yoruban art doesn't strike me as very West Jordan.
Miss Beasley said I collected Yoruban art?
Well, no, she didn't exactly say that. You brought them in, was what I think she said.
In that she is correct, said Wes. In that she is correct. In that she is indeed correct.
That was another West Jordan mannerism, repeating a phrase over and over until it finally seemed totally ironic or else mysteriously significant.
I did bring them in, at least in the sense that if it weren't for me, they wouldn't be here. I'll tell you something, Roger. Sometimes it really is fun being the mayor of Atlanta. I got all these pieces, or got them on loan, with about a dozen telephone calls, and for half of them I didn't even have to get on the telephone myself. Everybody's looking ahead. I called the National Museum in Lagos, Nigeria. I called the Hammer Collection. You know, Armand Hammer. I called the Linden Museum in Stuttgart, Germany. I called the Pace Gallery in New York City. By the way, Brother Roger, this is just you and me talking, right, Brother Wes and Brother Roger?
Oh, sure, said Roger. I mean, I don't even know why you're here.
You were very mysterious on the telephone with Gladys, I gather. Very mysterious, very mysterious.
The smile again.
Well, you'll see why in a minute. But go ahead, tell me about all this.
He gestured toward the divination cup and the ivory swords again.
I told all these people exactly what I was doing. I told them their stuff would be on loan and displayed prominently in the mayor's office. I didn't say for how long, and they didn't ask.
Well, that's not really true. They did ask, but only barely.
But you, Wes? As I remember, you used to laugh at all this Afrocentric business. I remember one night, when was it, 87, 88? You made so much fun of Jesse Jackson and his African-American pronouncement at that press conference, you remember? Wherever it was, Chicago, I think. That press conference where he started everybody using African-American instead of black. You remember that night? You had Albert Hill laughing so hard I thought he was going to die, and he liked Jesse.
Well, said the mayor, cocking his head and smiling more knowingly than ever, times change.
Times change, times change, and the polls change.
The polls?
The polls and the focus groups.
You use focus groups?
That we do, but don't get me started on all that. Have a seat,
he indicated the white couch,
and tell me what I have to thank for the honor of this visit.
So Roger took a seat on the couch, and West Jordan pulled up a big armchair on the other side of the coffee table and sat down and sank back comfortably. Roger said,
"Wes, do you by any chance know Farik Fannin, the football player?"
"Oh, yes," said Wes, rolling his eyes.
"I know him. I shared the dais with him at a special Junior Olympics event, I believe it was."
The smile on his face had a distinctly sardonic twist.
"What about him?"
Roger said, "I represent him."
"You? What on earth for?"
Roger took a deep breath and launched into the narrative of Fannin and the Freaknik party and the white student who somehow ended up in the canon's room at 2 a.m. and now claimed she was raped.
When he said, "Her father is Inman Armholster," the mayor sat bolt upright and slid forward to the edge of the chair and leaned toward Roger and exclaimed,
"You're kidding."
"That's exactly what I said when McNutter told me who she was," said Roger.
It wasn't a very lawyer-like response, but that's exactly what I said. You're kidding. He wasn't kidding.
And they want you to represent him? Isn't this a little outside your field?
The mayor was now leaning so far forward, with his hands clasped and his forearms resting on his thighs, his weight seemed to be centered over the balls of his feet.
"Oh, I wondered the same thing," said Roger.
"They've got two other lawyers on the case, Julian Salisbury, who's a very good white litigator, and Don Pickett, who's a very good black litigator. And they've got me."
"Yeah, I know them both," said the mayor.
"They've got me because, well, just a minute ago you asked me if I was Brother Roger, and you said you were Brother Wes. Does that still stand?"
"Sure."
"Well, then, I'll tell you exactly why they've hired me. I won't put any spin on it at all. They've hired me because they know I know you. They know we went to grade school and high school together, and, for that matter, Sunday school. They know we were fraternity brothers at Morehouse. They think you'll listen to me in a way you wouldn't listen to someone who hasn't known you from way back. It's as simple as that, and that's all I know."
Wes Jordan rose to his feet. He began to pace back and forth with a bemused look on his face, massaging the knuckles of his left hand with the fingers of his right. Then he stopped and said to Roger,
"Okay, let's assume that's sound thinking on their part. Just what do they think you're going to get me to do?" "In an arm holster? Jesus Christ! And just who is they? Who's paying for all this?"
"It's this new group of football boosters they've got, the Stingers.
All of whom are white and no Inman arm holster, no doubt. Do you have any idea?"
The mayor broke off the sentence and started pacing again.
"Okay. As I was saying, what are you supposed to be persuading me to do?"
"Well, they, we, whatever we want." Interrupting in a distracted way, as if unaware that Roger had said anything, all the while gazing out toward the murky clouds beyond the balcony, the mayor said,
"Do you have any idea of the potential of this thing? One of the greatest athletes to ever come out of South Atlanta, out of black Atlanta, and the daughter of one of the richest and most prominent men in North Atlanta, in white Atlanta, in Buckhead."
Then he looked at Roger and said with the faintest of smiles,
"So what does your client want me to do?"
"Well, Wes, what we want, above all, is to keep this thing quiet. Julian Salisbury and Don Pickett may be terrific litigators, but this is a case we can't win in any court. All that has to happen is for the whole thing to get out in public and the damage is done. But it can't be kept quiet just by saying nothing. Somebody has to step in and mediate. Mediate with Inman arm holster. Somebody has to calm a lot of very ruffled feathers, and they, and I happen to agree with them 100%, they can't think of anybody who could do it better than you. You have the trust of the Inman arm holsters of this city."
Wes stood still and gazed out through the big plate-glass window and began to smile, as if he had just seen something terribly amusing way over in Paulding or Douglas County. Then he looked at Roger with the same smile on his face.
"Roger," he said, "do you happen to know what get-out-the-vote money is? Sometimes it's called walking-around money."
"In a general way," said Roger, "I've heard the term. Why?"
"Well," said Wes Jordan, "what would you say it meant, in a general way?"
"I gather it refers to the money you have to spend on Election Day, or maybe starting a few days before, to alert your supporters in the poorer neighborhoods. I don't know, send sound trucks through and pay those people who stand on the corners near the polling places handing out leaflets, and get people to drive vans to take people to the polls, things like that. Why?"
Wes smiled, a bit too superciliously in Roger's estimation.
"That's what I always thought, too, Roger. But right after I announced my candidacy for mayor, Archie Blunt, remember Archie, congressman from the 5th District? Archie drops by and he says, "Wes, this is the first time you've ever run in something this big, a citywide election. In the first month of the campaign, your knowledge of how politics actually work will increase by 100%. In the second month, it'll increase 200%. And in the third, it'll increase 400%. And you'll still be in kindergarten." I thanked him in a patronizing way, probably. I liked him, but I didn't consider him very bright. And I continued my preparations to run on the merits, which were all in my favor, I figured. The very next morning, I got my first surprise. There, on my desk, is a stack of letters this high. Clipped to each letter is a check made out to my campaign. The letter itself is a contract between me and the organization that sent it. One, I remember, was from some gay rights organization. All I had to do was sign off on this letter saying that I would come out in favor of same-sex marriages, survivors' rights for same-sex couples, gay sex education starting in elementary school, criminal sanctions against anti-gay bigotry. I can't even remember it all. And I could have the check, which was for $20,000. I disdained it on the merits and had my secretary send it right back. First, it was absolute rubbish. And second, my core constituency, our brothers and sisters, couldn't care less about making life easier for homosexuals, black or white. And when these gay rights groups, who are all white boys, of course, start trying to compare their struggle—it's always struggle—with our folks, I mean they're comparing a lot of white boys hugging and kissing each other with the people rising up from slavery, it makes the smoke start coming out of your ears. So I figure I've made a can't-miss decision. I've returned the letter and the check with a polite note saying thanks but no thanks, and I think that's the end of it. Then, 4 days later, I see a front-page headline on this weekly, the Five-Pointer it's called. I'm denounced as a homophobe opportunist who won't support even the most fundamental gay rights. You might say, well, so what? The Five-Pointer circulation is 15,000 at the most. It's a so-called alternative newspaper. But it's very popular among white homosexuals. And so I've just lost the gay vote without even opening my mouth on the subject. Every letter in that stack proposed the same deal. Bind yourself to our agenda, and you can keep the money. After a couple of months, you're beginning to pant for money. You're beginning to need it, the way you need food and air. These campaigns devour money. And by now, the vendors are all too smart to sell you anything on credit. You start thinking back to all those checks you turned down in such a high-minded way. You start wondering if you couldn't review your positions and find room under your umbrella for some of these really not so terrible special interest organizations and their $20,000 checks, because you have now learned an elemental lesson, which is nobody, nobody wins a citywide election strictly on the merits. You must have two things, money and organization. And by organization, I mean you've got to have people who know every single neighborhood, particularly in South Atlanta. Which brings me to get out the vote money. In the closing days of the election, you're going to be approached by people claiming they can deliver X number of votes. Some guy wearing a shirt with no collar and a Braves warm-up jacket will come up to you and say, "I got Mechanicsville, but I gotta know right now it's $10,000. You hesitate, partly because he has such a belligerent, disrespectful tone in his voice, whereupon he says, "You don't want it? Fuck you. This is the deal. I didn't come here to negotiate. $10,000 up front or fuck you, pal." Here's some red-eyed moron screaming fuck you in your face, the face of the next mayor of Atlanta. But by now you know there's no use getting on your high horse. So you stand there and take it. Maybe this is a guy who can deliver Mechanicsville.
That's where organization comes in. You've got to have people who know these neighborhoods, who know who can or can't deliver a neighborhood or part of a neighborhood, and who can talk their language and who's willing to get his hands dirty.
His hands dirty? Said Roger.
Oh, yes, said Wes. After you've made your decision who to pay off, you've got to have somebody, you can't do it yourself, somebody who delivers the $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, whatever, to these operators, in cash. After you deliver the money, you've got no control over what happens to it, and no redress. You've made a verbal agreement with some character who doesn't speak English beyond take it or leave it and fuck you.
What does happen to it?
Assuming the guy can do what he says he can, he gets on the telephone early the morning of the election, and he starts calling all the people on his list, all the potential voters, and he says, "What you say, baby? How about getting your ass out of bed and coming on out here and fulfill your civic duty? I'm talking about voting, baby."
And the guy'll say, "I don't know, man. What I got coming from it?"
And your newest ardent supporter will say, $30.
And the guy'll say, "Can't you do no better than that?"
And your vote-getter-outer says, "30's top dollar this year, bro."
And the guy'll say, "Okay, shit. Who I supposed to vote for?"
"Wesley Dobbs Jordan."
"Say who? Wesley Dobbs who the fuck?"
"Never mind, baby. Just come on down here, and I'll tell you."
"Okay, shit. I'll see you down there. You sure you can't do no better than 30?
"When does he get paid?" asked Roger. "How does he get paid?"
"He gets paid after he votes," said the mayor of Atlanta. "As for precisely how, that I can't tell you, because I've never seen it done, and I don't intend to. But you can be sure of one thing. It's paid in cash."
Roger said, "What exactly does the operator, or whatever he's called, what does he get out of it?"
"That I don't know either, but judging by how much you give one of these people and how many votes you get in his district, I'd say he keeps about half or maybe a little more than that. Little enough to pay for such a vital service is what everybody figures."
"But isn't that illegal?" asked Roger. "Isn't that buying votes?"
"That it is, Brother Roger, that it is. And except in the rare case, there's no other way to win a citywide election. And today you'd better have $500,000 set aside just for that, just for handing out cash to voters. And the more you can devote to that, the better your chances. A full $1,000,000 increases your chances by 50%. And would you like to know who's guaranteeing Andre Fleet $1,000,000 in get-out-the-vote money when the time comes?"
"Guaranteeing who?"
"Andre Fleet."
"The Operation Hire guy? He's going to run against you?"
"He's already running against me. He's making the rounds of the hoods, talking to every group that's willing to sit still to hear a speaker. He actually calls them that, the hoods. I'm not kidding. He must think this is a made-for-TV movie. The hoods."
Withering sarcasm.
"He's calling me everything in the book. I'm a blue blood. I'm part of the Morehouse elite. I'm in the back pocket of the White Chamber of Commerce. I'm an Oreo, black on the outside and white on the inside, only I ain't even very black on the outside. I'm a beige half-brother."
Direct quote.
"It's time Atlanta had its first black mayor. Maynard Jackson, Andy Young, Bill Campbell, and me. We've all been high yella. I'm not making this stuff up. You ought to hear him, Roger. People bring me tapes. You know what he looks like?"
"I've seen pictures of him."
"Well, he's tall, 6'5" or something. He's young. 5 years ago, he was still playing in the NBA. He's got a lot of muscles, and the ladies love him. And he's dark, brother."
The deep put on voice.
"He's strong coffee. He's from the streets, brother. From the hood. I'd like to know what streets he thinks he grew up on. His father owned a service station in West End, and his mother owned a beauty parlor called Rita's Beauty Box, and he grew up in Collier Heights. Collier Heights! What kind of real life does he think he grew up with in his hood? Squirrels and robins and lightning bugs? He's too much, Mr. Andre Fleet is, but people are listening to him. He's saying that ever since Maynard Jackson became the first black mayor of Atlanta, the black political leadership has been in the hands of a light-skinned elite. The Morehouse elite, he keeps calling it. And somehow we're in league with the white establishment. The Piedmont Driving Club elite, he calls it. To enrich each other at the expense of the ordinary people of the streets. All of us, Maynard Jackson, Andy Young, Bill Campbell, we're all the Morehouse elite, even Andy, who grew up in Louisiana and went to Dillard in New Orleans, and Bill Campbell, who grew up in North Carolina and went to Vanderbilt in Nashville, Tennessee. It's one of those situations in which the truth doesn't matter, because deep down we're all Morehouse blue bloods, no matter what the facts are. We're not really black. It's the worst kind of demagoguery, Roger, the worst kind of pandering. But he's scoring. Oh, he's scoring. We run our own polls, and we run our own focus groups out in his beloved hoods, and he's scoring. If the election was held today, I'd be in a lot of trouble. For one thing, he has a really solid commitment for $1 million in get-out-the-vote money.
You mentioned that, said Roger. From whom?
Wes Jordan cocked his head to one side and put on a cold smile. Inman Armholster. Roger was dumbfounded. He fought back the impulse to say, "You're kidding." He ransacked his brain to try to figure out the logic of where this put or didn't put Wes in dealing with Armholster in the matter of Farik Fanon. Finally, he shook his head and said, "I'll be damned." "Atlanta's a small world," said the mayor. "If you look closely, there's a handful of people who do everything."
"How does that alter your position when it comes to my client?"
"It doesn't," said Wes Jordan. "That's a completely separate matter." His face took on a familiar, ironic smile. "What you've tossed in my lap this morning is something that could blow this city apart. I just wanted to make sure you had the full measure of Mr. Inman Armholster."
"Why would a man like that be backing someone like Andre Fleet?"
"Oh, it's not very complicated," said Wes. "He thinks he's going to win. In these all-black elections, I don't see white businessmen wasting time on ideology and issues. It's more like, can I do business with him or not? And I'm sure Armholster is all ready to do business with Andre Fleet. That's what is known as the Atlanta Way."
"The Atlanta Way?"
"Exactly," said Wes Jordan. "The Atlanta Way. Did you ever unravel a baseball?"
"No."
"It's not a particularly illuminating exercise, but I used to enjoy doing it when I was 10 or 11 years old. After you take the white horsehide cover off, you come across a ball of white string, or it's like string. There's about a mile of the stuff, once you start unraveling it, all this white string. Finally, you get down to the core, which is black, a small, hard, black rubber ball. Well, that's Atlanta. The hard core, if we're talking politics, are the 280,000 black folks in South Atlanta. They, or their votes, control the city itself. Wrapped all around them, like all that white string, are 3 million white people in North Atlanta and all those counties, Cobb, DeKalb, Gwinnett, Forsyth, Cherokee, Paulding. So how do those white millions deal with that small black core? That's what leads to the Atlanta Way. Remember that billion-dollar expansion of the airport back when Maynard was mayor? Well, Maynard got the business interests together and said, "Boys, here's a billion-dollar project." So they're salivating, of course, and then he says, "And 30% of it's going to minority contractors." They gulped, but only for a moment. $700 million was nothing to look down your nose at either. And in no time they were salivating all over again. And they figured they'd just make do with the minority contractors some way or other. Later on, Maynard said, "That airport created 25 black millionaires. He was proud of it, and he had every right to be. That's the Atlanta way."
Roger said, "Where does my client figure in all this?"
"I don't know yet," said Wes Jordan. "Maybe not at all. I need to look into a few things and talk to some people."
"For God's sake, Wes, be careful who you talk to about this. All this thing has to do is get out on the rumor circuit, and we might as well give up on containing it. It'll blow the city apart, as you say, on its own power."
"I'm mindful of that."
"What can I tell my colleagues?"
"You can tell them that I'm fully aware of the explosive nature of the situation, that I will try to think of the best way to approach Inman Armholster, and that I will do something quickly. You know, Roger, you and your dream team had better face up to the fact that an awful lot of people, it seems to me, already know about this thing. There's McNutter and his wife, who doesn't strike me as any taciturn pillar of discretion, and there are people at Tech, people in this Stingers organization. There's the dream team and all your families.